all about food. And thank you so much for joining me today. As I've been saying for the last few weeks, this is a time to tune in love. And I thank you for joining me and taking the time to do that. Tune in love. You know, I used to say tune in live, and then by accident I wanted to type tune in love, and I thought, no, that's not by accident. That's the universe telling me we all need to tune in love. And it was a especially hard week. We all know about the attacks on Paris, and there's so much violence in the world today. For me, it was difficult because I lived in France for 4 years. I studied music with a voice teacher in Paris. I did a lot of things there and had my own heartful connection to friends and experiences there. But there's so much violence all over the planet, and it's not just the Daesh. There's so much going on. And the problem is it's also in our own country. We have a lot of violence here to humans and to non-human animals. So what I want to encourage everyone to do is not go the easy route and start hating. That's not going to bring us any solution. It's not going to bring us where we need to be. We need to tune in love. And one way we can do that, the easiest way to do that, is to stop eating animals and to stop the exploitation and violence in our own communities by killing and slaughtering non-human animals. And we can do it so deliciously, and that's why I'm so excited to speak to my first guest, Jay Astafa. He's a wonderful vegan chef, and we're going to find out a lot more about him right now. Welcome, Jay, to It's All About Food.
Hi, Karen. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
You're welcome. Now, you won't remember this, but I met you when I visited the Rockville Center Three Brothers restaurant, which has now moved to Farmingdale. And you were a younger Jay Astafa at that time.
I actually do remember. You came in during brunch on a Sunday, right?
Yeah, right. That's right.
Yeah.
I brought my very non-vegan family, and we all enjoyed all kinds of wonderful dishes. And it was so much fun for a vegan to be able to have brunch. There aren't a lot of brunch places for vegans, although there are many restaurants today that accommodate vegans. Brunch, I think, is the least served of all vegan menu items. So that was really fun.
Like brunch, I think like the only places you can get that in New York City is probably like Champs Restaurant. There's not many places to get a vegan brunch.
Right. So that was really fun. And also on Long Island, there have been a number of vegan restaurants over the years that have come and unfortunately have gone. And I don't think the climate was ready, but we're ready now, and we're ready for Three Brothers. So we're going to hear more about that and how you got started. So let's start with that. How did the young Jay Astafa, you're still young, but the younger Jay Astafa, get turned on to veganism?
So I went vegan when I was in 2007, when I was 15. Prior to that, I was vegetarian for 5 months. And for me, I went vegan because I saw a PETA video on how I think it was your meat. And then after that, I just couldn't eat meat anymore. And I went vegan because, like, milk and eggs made me feel guilty. So then I just started to, like, teach myself how to cook. Because, like, when you first go vegan, you don't really have too many options out there. So you kind of have to learn how to cook for yourself. And then in 2009, my dad opened a restaurant in 2007. So I would, like, work there occasionally. But then in 2009, it was the summer when I was 16. And I was looking for something to do that summer. And I found out about Daya mozzarella cheese, so I decided to add that to my dad's restaurant. So we started, like, a small menu with, like, the vegan pizza and the heroes and stuff. So we did, like, a really small menu. And then at first, like, it was, like, really slow with the vegan options. Like, not too many people caught on. And then a few months later, I decided I was going to do, like, a whole vegan menu. So we did, like, the appetizers. We did pastas, entrees. And then we did, like, vegan desserts. So everything that we had on our regular menu, I created, like, a vegan version on the menu. And then the New York Times wrote about us in 2009. That's, like, when people started about us more.
That doesn't hurt, having the New York Times talk about you. Great press.
And, like, one of the reasons I did the vegan menu there, because I noticed that there was, like, no vegan options on Long Island, like, very few at that time.
Yeah, well, it was great. A lot of fun. And I'm not quite sure why we don't have more of that. I think Italian food lends itself so nicely to be veganized.
Yeah, definitely. Like, for our menu, like, we keep with the traditional, like, Italian techniques. We just use, like, our own cheeses. Like, I make my own cashew milk mozzarella. And, like, we make our own ingredients in-house. So we did that in, like, 2009. So we opened, we had a full vegan menu for Three Brothers Vegan Cafe. And then we did that for a while. And then in 2013, we moved to a new location in Farmingdale. So that's where the current Three Brothers is. And just this past summer, we decided to open an all-vegan restaurant.
Yay!
On Long Island. So right now it's the only all-vegan restaurant on Long Island.
I know. And we certainly need more, but I'm glad you're there. Oh, it's a little hard to get to for us in New York City, but it's not impossible and definitely worth a trip. And I hope it does very, very well.
Thank you. And I'm hoping to open, like, probably next year, a version of that restaurant in New York City so the New York City people can enjoy it too.
Okay. Well, yeah, you got to have a lot of support. It's Manhattan is a pricey place.
Yeah.
Those rents are tough. Okay. Well, this is great. And, you know, I'm just curious. It's hard running a restaurant. And, you know, how did your father deal with this when his son was saying, let's add these foods to the menu?
Well, my dad didn't really know much about, like, vegan cuisine or, like, the vegan lifestyle. So he just, like, let me do, like, pretty much whatever I wanted at that time. So, like, he was, like, pretty – he just let me – like, he just ordered the ingredients for me, and I just, like, created the menu for him. So at that time, I would have to work at the restaurant every day because, like, I would have to educate people how to, like, make the vegan food. And nowadays, like, I don't really have to do that often because, like, everyone knows – like, my dad knows how to cook vegan. My mom knows how to cook vegan. So I don't really have to teach them that much.
Excellent. You know, I didn't realize that the Three Brothers in Rockville Center opened in 2007. It seemed when I went there that it had been there for forever. It just seemed very well established. And so was your dad always into cooking, and were you raised to know how to cook?
Yeah, like, my dad always worked in restaurants, and then he opened his first restaurant in 2007. So, like, but at home, like, my family would always, like, cook.
Okay, well, one thing I'm always telling people is to get back into the kitchen and learn how to cook. We don't all need to be chefs, but I think it would be better for us, for the planet, for our health, for so many reasons. And you just learn to appreciate food a lot more when you know what goes in it. Most people have no idea what's in their food.
Definitely. And it's, like, so easy to teach yourself. Like, when I became vegan, I knew nothing about, like, cooking. And I would just, like, read cookbooks, and, like, I taught myself how to cook. And then in 2011, I decided to go to culinary school. Then I went to the Natural Gourmet Institute.
Mm-hmm. And how is it there for someone who wants to cook vegan?
Well, they're very accommodating. Like, for a vegan, like, you don't have to handle any, like, chicken or meat or eggs. And then you don't even have to answer, like, the test questions. Because, like, prior to that, I went to, like, a regular culinary school, like, at a local community college. And, like, I just stayed there for 2 months, but they wanted me to handle chicken, and I just couldn't do it. Like, after they asked me to handle chicken, I didn't want to do that. So I dropped out of that program.
Good. Smart move. Interesting. I had no idea, even as far as test questions are concerned. So that's nice that the Natural Institute doesn't require you to answer those questions. Good. I plead the fifth. And so you've got a few wonderful projects. You already mentioned your new restaurant it's in Copaig, right?
Yeah. So, like, my dad kind of just randomly found that location, and, like, before, and it was, like, totally his idea to do, like, a restaurant there. And then I just signed on to the project for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been, like, pretty successful.
Yeah, well, the one in Farmingdale, the few times I've been there, it's been packed. So you need more space.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I think people, like, really need, like, some type of people like to dine at all vegan establishments.
Yes.
So that's why it's, like, better, like, the restaurant. Because, like, we can do, like, more – we can, like, make our own cheese at the restaurant. We have, like, more room.
Very good.
Yeah.
And you've done a number of other projects, so let's talk about those. You had a pop-up series?
Yeah, so I started my pop-up series. Like, I had a few different ones. I did a J Kitchen that was in 2013, so that started as a two-day pop-up, and that actually made me want to start branch out into a whole, into a catering company. So that's where my current catering company, JS Lava Catering, was born out of, that 2-day pop-up restaurant. Cause like people after that, people just started asking me for events. Then I have, I had that catering company, and just recently I did a new pop-up series called Plant by JS Lava, which I'm hoping to open into a fine dining restaurant probably by next year.
So in your restaurant, your dad's restaurant, and in this new vegan restaurant, you have classic Italian cuisine.
I like to describe it as like classic comfort Italian cuisine, and we have a few like new American dishes too.
But your catering and your pop-up restaurants are a little different, aren't they?
I like to like describe myself as having like two distinct cooking styles. Like I'm known for my comfort Italian food, and I'm also known for like my high-end like vegetable-focused cuisine.
So I was at the Veg News Comfort Food Shindig Extravaganza a couple of months ago and got to sample some adorable little bites that you were preparing. There was the grilled cheese with tomato soup.
Yeah, those were really popular. And the grilled cheese, we make our own cheddar cheese from cashew milk.
It was awesome.
Thank you.
And, you know, who doesn't love grilled cheese? And it's definitely a grilled cheese tomato soup combo from my early background. I mean, that was just a growing up lovely staple that I stopped eating, period.
And, like, you can take, like, those comfort foods, and, like, once you make them, like, miniature, they automatically become, like, a whole different thing, like a high-end experience.
Yeah. And then, of course, you had the burger, fries, and shakes, all in miniature, which are so adorable. And what else did you have?
Oh, we did mini pizzas and customized boxes. Those, like, one of my clients always requests those.
Yeah, everybody loves pizza.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay, so you've accomplished so much, and where are you going from here? What can you do?
I definitely want to open, like, one of my longest goals has been to open a restaurant in New York City. So I definitely want to focus on that, but also just, like, growing my catering company, and I also want to I'm planning to write a cookbook soon, and lots of people are asking me to do, like, a cheese line, so I have to figure out how to do that, too.
Yeah, well, that's definitely the next level, and a number of people and companies have started going there. But just like cheese is made from animal milk, there are so many different kinds and flavors from regions all around the world. We can have as many, if not more, plant-based cheeses made from different regions all around the world.
I think you can have, like, cheese, because sometimes people, like, on Twitter, they told me one time I can't call my mozzarella because it's not made with cow's milk. But, like, if you look into, like, the cheese world, there's so many different types of milks that are used for cheese. So, like, I think there's going to be a day where cashew milk is, like, the norm for cheese, and just, like, it's going to be pretty much standard.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, maybe we should start getting creative about our cheese names. Like, I love that many artisanal products in France, for example, are named after the regions that they come from. So, I don't know, maybe we can have a Copé cheddar or something like that. Oh, yeah. Okay, well, we also have to get the FDA on board because they define foods and what's in them in order for them to be named like mayonnaise or milk or cheese.
Yeah, that happened to, like, I just read something that happened to Hampton Creek from, like, the Beyond Mayo, which is,
yes,
yeah, just mayo.
Yeah, so it's that story is ongoing. We have a little news report on our website, Responsible Eating and Living, where we talk about a number of things that have happened in the mayo wars. And it's quite fascinating. There's a lot of corruption coming from the egg board, governmental organizations that support the egg industry, and we need to have change happen. It's going to happen, and it's happening right now, which is kind of exciting to see it happening.
I definitely agree. I think it's just like the egg industry is getting scared that, like, there's competition.
It's all about money. I like to say it's all about food, but it really is all about money. And it's important that our vegan businesses succeed, so I'm glad that you're doing well. So what are some of the favorites in your new restaurant in Copenhagen?
Well, one of my favorites is like the pizza that we make with the cashew milk mozzarella. Like I like the margarita pizza, which is like a standard pizza with like the San Marzano sauce and cashew milk mozzarella. Another one is our pizza bianca, which we do with like garlic, mozzarella, and we also make our homemade ricotta cheese. And then we also have like pasta dishes like fettuccine Alfredo. That's one of my favorites. Mm. And we do dishes like seitan piccata.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's all good.
And also our waffle cauliflower. That's like one of our top appetizers. That's
Oh, right. I've had that. That's really decadent.
Yeah.
Now I'm really glad that they came on the scene with their mozzarella. I have to admit that I was never a big fan of it, taste-wise and texture-wise, but I'm just glad it was there.
And then, the Zea mozzarella just inspired me. Like when I first found out about it, that's like what inspired me to like made it accessible to like do like the vegan options at the restaurant. Because like before that, I didn't really know how to make my own cheese.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it was groundbreaking using tapioca starch in the recipe. We all learned a great deal. It raised the bar. It moved us all onward and upward, and we're all benefiting from it. They've got some great products. Yeah. So, but I want to say I like your cashew cheese better than the Zea cheese. Whoop.
Oh. And like at the restaurant, like half of the people aren't vegans. Like when they try like the cheese, they're always like really impressed. Like how like the cheese is similar to like regular dairy mozzarella.
Now, what about desserts? I know you brought in vegan treats desserts. Are you making your own dessert at the restaurants?
Oh, we still use like vegan treats. Like I like the stuff like Danielle Konya makes.
Yeah, they're really good and really sweet. Good. Okay. Well, what now? I always say that the best way to get people eating plants, getting people to go vegan, is to put delicious tasting food in their mouths. And we need access to these delicious creating foods. So you're doing an amazing job providing access and delicious food.
And that's like one of my forms of activism, like through food. Because like before, when I first went vegan, I was just looking like a way to become an animal activist, and like I found food, and that's like how I do like my activism.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking about Tune in Love before, and this is the best way to do it. People need to know that they will not be deprived. How many times have you heard people say, "I can't give up cheese"?
Yeah, and I also like telling people like sometimes people have like a stereotype that you have to be vegan to eat vegan foods. So, like I always like to tell them like you don't have to go vegan right away to like enjoy vegan food.
Yeah, that's like cracking the door open. Although I want to say that what do I want to say? I have difficulty with what the ideal way is to spread the word about vegan food. I know there are the abolitionists that say vegan all the way or there's no other way but being vegan. And in my heart, I really believe that. On the other hand, I don't know if it's the most effective way with the current culture. Some people really need to be treated gently as they make their transition. And I know that they would back away if they were told they had to go all the way.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think you just should be like a good example, and then like people will just like catch on.
Right.
Yeah.
Be a good example. Look really hot, which you do. and make great tasting food. Yeah. And for you, it was the animals, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, I became vegan because like, I remember growing up, I was always curious like how meat came to the table. And then when I just like researched one day, I was just like shocked and I just could not eat meat anymore after that.
Now, your family's supporting all of this, but has anyone in your family gone vegan?
Not fully vegan. Like, my mom's, like, mostly vegetarian. She still eats fish, so she calls her, she's a pescatarian. But, like, no one in my family has gone fully vegan yet.
Yeah, it's tough when it's related to your business. It takes a lot of extra courage to do that. Yeah. Okay, well, you're the next generation, and we just improve as it goes on. Really, really good. Well, Jay, What else you want to tell me before I let you go? Any big events coming up, things we should know about?
Oh, I'm actually going tomorrow. I'm flying out to Miami for the Seafood and Wine Festival. I'm really excited about that. I'm doing a burger battle on Thursday, so I'm going to be doing my Seitan Beat Burger. It's a competition between 12 other chefs, so I'm representing New York. And then on Saturday, I'm doing a demo there, so I'm really excited.
That's in Miami.
Yeah. And just on Sunday, I did Thank Living for the Woodstock Animal Sanctuary. So that was like a really fun, awesome experience.
How many people were there?
There was about 250 people.
Whoa!
Yeah. Prior to that, the day before on Friday, I actually did a tasting menu. So it was a pretty big, pretty busy week for catering.
What did you make for the Thank Living dinner? Just to give people an idea of what they can have instead of the dead bird.
And so for like the first course, we did like a sweet potato butternut squash soup. I always like doing a butternut squash type of soup. Mm-hmm. And then for our main dish, we had two options. One was for gluten-free. We did a pecan crusted rosemary tempeh. And then we also did, for the regular version, we did a seitan turkey roast. I really like making my turkey roast, and I use yuba skin to create that nice crispy skin.
Love that. Mm. Yeah.
And then we just did all the traditional Thanksgiving sides. We did like truffle mashed potatoes, cornbread stuffing, cranberry sauce. We did haricot vert, which people actually really like the green beans. I think they questioned me like how I did the green beans, but I think like the French green beans are like the perfect green bean.
J'adore les haricots verts.
And then we also did like Brussels sprouts. And then we topped the roast with mushroom gravy.
Sounds pretty good. Yum. Why not?
You don't even have to go, like, all the way. Some people, like, the roast takes a little while, but I think, like, Thanksgiving is all about, like, the side dishes.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, even back in the day when it was hard to find vegan substitutes for milk and butter and eggs, and we were, like, 20, 30 years ago figuring our way, it really wasn't hard with mashed potatoes and pumpkin pie and cranberry sauce and stuffing. Those were easy vegan foods.
And then, like, at my family, like, Thanksgiving, like, we actually make all the sides all vegan. So, like, I think, like, everyone can, like, pretty much if you have, like, family who doesn't eat all vegan, like, you can just make all the side dishes vegan and no one will notice.
Beautiful. Who's hungry? Raise your hand. My mouth is watering. Jay, thank you so much for joining me on Soul About Food. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I look forward to tasting more of your art at any event where you're at soon that I happen to be at as well.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Bye. Ooh, that was Chef Jay Astafa, and you can find more about Jay Astafa at jayastafa.com. That's jayastafa.com. And really, that was a delicious story, wasn't it? And I love when young people get the message about the importance of delicious plant foods, and then do something about it. Do something wonderful. Do something delicious. Okay, so I just wanted to bring up a number of things before we move on to the second part of the program. And what did I want to bring up tonight? I don't know if there's still time left to get it together in your schedule, but for those of you that can get to Brooklyn, there's an event tonight that I thought sounded pretty interesting. It's sponsored by Lantern Books. We've had many Lantern Books authors here on It's All About Food. And Brighter Green, we had Mia McDonald on several years ago. She has a wonderful nonprofit. They are doing an in-depth discussion on the state of conservation, development, and protection of animals and local communities in Central and Eastern Africa with three experts in the field, Jean Kim Chay, that's C-H-A-I-X, don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, and Josphat Ngonyo, and Ambassador Nehemia Rotich. And they're both visiting from Kenya. And There's a documentary that you can watch that is on Netflix to learn more about the struggle to protect the Virunga National Park in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and that's called Virunga. If you're interested in attending, it is tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. in Brooklyn. You can email info@brightergreen.org. Info@brightergreen.org. The other thing I wanted to bring to your attention, also for those in the New York City area, there is the Anti-Fur Society Vegan Conference and Cruelty-Free Fashion Show this Saturday, Landmark on the Park at 160 Central Park West in the heart of Manhattan. The website is A, like Apple, F like fashion, S like show, conference.org, AFSconference.org. There will be speakers and fabulous food and a fashion show. And my partner Gary and I will actually be there. We'll be filming some of the fashion show and then presenting some of the wonderful things that we see at a later time. So head over there on Saturday and say hi. I would love to meet you. Let's get on with the next part of the program, because I think we've got a lot of material to cover, and I understand my guests are on hold. So let's move on to part two, and we're going to be inviting Kip Anderson and Keegan Kuhn, the co-directors of the documentary Cowspiracy. They now have a new book out, The Sustainability Secret, Rethinking Our Diet to Transform the World. Welcome, guys, to It's All About Food.
Thank you.
Okay, now, Kip, I want to calibrate your voice. Can you say hi?
Hi, this is Kip. Thank you for having us on.
Okay, and Keegan?
This is Keegan Kuhn. Thank you so much for having us.
Okay. I don't know if I'm going to get that right, but I have that to calibrate later on. Okay, Kip and Keegan. So you've had some wonderful success with your documentary, Cowspiracy. Congratulations.
Thanks so much.
And you had Leonardo DiCaprio producing it, and that got it to Netflix, something like that?
Yes, it did. It's similar to how he did with Vrunga. He has a deal with Netflix, and he's bringing environmentally based films to Netflix. And in our case, he was the first one to bring the film to Netflix, whereas Vrunga, Netflix brought to him. And he watched it over a year ago and was blown away, and he wanted to help out. So he's our executive producer for the Netflix release.
That's wonderful, because it's not easy to get on Netflix. It's expensive, and you need to work through some middlemen to get there, right?
Absolutely.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. And so to have Leonardo DiCaprio take the film to Netflix was phenomenal. We couldn't wish for anything better than that.
So the interesting thing for me reading The Sustainability Secret, Rethinking Our Diet to Transform the World, is it's a personal thing. I've been vegan for 25 years. I've been vegetarian for a lot longer, and I've spent most of my life in activism, and I lived through most of the things that you talk about in this book. It's like a history book, and it's really great for people to read who want to get up to date on this issue regarding eating animals and its impact on the environment and health and cruelty, all of those things. And so it was kind of chilling in some ways to remember when these things were going on. Frustrating on one hand that at the time I was executive director of Earth Save International and working with Howard Lyman. You mentioned him in the book. We put out newsletters, and I remember trying to get information or get other environmental organizations on board to talk about animal agriculture, and it just wasn't happening at all. And to reread that, like I said, it was frustrating on one hand. On the other hand, I'm glad that it's out there now, and it's getting so much more press, and now we can really make some headway. So thanks for putting that together.
Well, it's the sad truth is that, you know, these environmental organizations, many of the large environmental organizations, are still failing to properly address animal agriculture as a leading cause of environmental degradation. But we are seeing strides being made. We are moving forward, and I think we're going to see more and more organizations starting to talk about it, starting to address it properly, because it's absolutely essential. It's the only way we're going to see global sustainability be a reality.
Let's talk about the beginning of the book. I love Chris Hedges, and he wrote the foreword to your book. I was ecstatic when I learned that he became vegan, but also surprised that it took him so long to get there. And he talks a little bit about it in the foreword, but that's kind of the profound thing about this food issue that some people who are so connected to the exploitation on this planet with so many issues on so many levels and have seen the worst of the worst, and yet when it comes to animal agriculture, they have the veil on. They're unaware.
Yeah, it's a tough thing, you know, it's essentially our eating habits are essentially an addiction, whether it's something that comes from our past of how we grew up. You have this bond with your family of how you grew up, like myself. I grew up around the table, and sometimes when you challenge someone's eating habits, you're challenging really their heritage and who they are. And so not only is it an addiction when you deal with, say, dairy products, the castle morphine and the habitual thing of doing something every single day, whether it's brushing your teeth in a certain way, it's also tied to your heritage. So it's a really tough thing to overcome, but once, as you know, when you do, it's so incredibly liberating. But it takes some time for some people.
Yeah, but Chris Hedges, for those who aren't familiar with him, he's an incredible journalist, and he writes so passionately about exploitation all over the world, and he was a vegetarian too for a while, but not vegan.
Yeah, you know, it is a blind spot for a lot of progressive people that they don't look at the impacts of their own oppressive behavior of others. I think Chris's wife Eunice Wong had a lot to do with his transformation to a vegan lifestyle, and they're just a really powerful couple who are doing so much to raise awareness of justice on so many levels, including animals.
Yeah, well, I believe that once you realize that you don't need to eat animals to live and to live well, and that we don't need to exploit them, all the other exploitation issues become very clear. All of a sudden, you're aware of all of them.
Yeah, it really does. Once you, for me in particular, the kind of domino effect of when I went vegan, how many things open up in clarity in your life of things that you're maybe not really living your truth, or when you see people, you know, say you're doing yoga or some spiritual leaders, they're talking about certain things, yet they're doing other things. Everything just has more clarity to it and truth to it that, you know, just kind of the light really turns on so many subjects all across the board that was really interesting going through that.
Well, you know, you mentioned yoga, and we've imported the yoga exercise to this country and maybe a little bit of the meditation, but the full yoga practice involves a vegan diet.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I say. A lot of people say, oh, I'm a yogi or a yoga teacher, and then say they're eating animal products. I'm like, no, you're an asana teacher. You know, you teach asana practice, which is a part of yoga, but to say you're a yoga teacher, you're a yogi, that incorporates all eight limbs of yoga, and the very, very, very first one is ahimsa, nonviolence. And if you can't get that part of an asana practice, that's not until limb four. So, you know, everything, the foundation of particular yoga is ahimsa. So, yeah, you're right.
Okay, let's touch on a bunch of things in this book. And I think it's not the central part of the book, but I think it was a clever piece and an important piece that got people interested in the movie, especially with your trailer, and that's the expose of the environmental groups who are not being honest, who are not telling the truth about one of the most serious environmental disasters on this planet.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, for many of the large organizations like Greenpeace and Sierra Club, their focus is on fossil fuels. And when it comes to animal agriculture, they're basically silent. There might be a few articles buried deep in their website where they mention the impacts of animal agriculture, but they don't address the real solution to it. But you would think that an organization who has their mission statement is to protect and save the environment, that personal lifestyle choices would be at the forefront of the issue, or at least addressing the fact that animal agriculture is a leading cause of deforestation, species extinction, habitat loss, water consumption, water pollution, ocean dead zones. I mean, literally the list goes on and on and on. So the fact that they're not addressing it as their forefront issue is shocking and was a major focus of the film.
And, I mean, we know that they weren't focusing on it because they believed it would affect their bottom line. They wouldn't be getting some of the funding that they needed to keep going. So they compromised.
Yeah, but since the making, since the making of the film, we actually found it's even worse. We saw, I don't know if you call it a marketing report, but it was a big report that showed if these environmental groups do talk about animal agriculture and reducing meat consumption, will this be a win campaign? And they analyzed whether it'd be a win campaign. The conclusion was it wouldn't. So they didn't do it, which is unbelievable, which shows that, you know, they're more concerned with the sustainability of their own themselves and that of the planet. They're more concerned with profits over the planet, and it's just unbelievable.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure that some of them are ignorant, and maybe it's what you were talking about before because of how we've been brought up. People don't want to see. I remember talking with one woman at Greenpeace, and we were talking about refrigerants and their campaign to change a lot of things related to hydrofluorocarbons, things like that. And the woman I was talking to was vegetarian but not vegan and was clueless about the health impacts of dairy, the environmental impacts of dairy, and the cruelty related to dairy.
Yeah, and it's shocking. You would think that organizations whose focus is saving the environment would be extremely well-versed in all the environmental ills facing the planet. And so some of them do seem to be ignorant, but it's shocking. How could the executive director of an organization, of a rainforest organization, not know that animal agriculture is the leading cause of rainforest destruction? And so that's where the conspiracy plays in, is that are they truly ignorant, or are they willingly avoiding this topic because it's unpopular and it potentially will hurt their donor base? And that's the really disturbing conspiratorial aspect of this whole story.
There's a lot of people that talk about palm oil, and we definitely need to be talking about it. It's an important subject, and it has tremendous impact on the rainforest. And I'm glad that you brought up the Rainforest Action Network in your book and talked a bit about it. But sometimes I think that they're focusing on that because they don't want to focus on the animal agriculture issue.
Absolutely. You know, the palm oil is a major issue and absolutely needs to be addressed, but Indonesian palm oil production has cleared about 26 million acres of rainforest versus animal agriculture is about 136 million acres, so vastly more. And RAN, you know, their first campaign was against Burger King. So you would think that would have been their, you know, you would think it'd be their focus still today. And yet, you know, they don't have animal agriculture as their main focus. It's not even listed on top of their website.
I remember when I was working with EarthSave from 1999 on, early 2000s. The internet was kind of young at the time, but they had a lot of information on their website about soy and animal agriculture. And then I remember visiting them again more recently, and it was all gone.
Yeah, and it's why is it? Why is that? You know, Greenpeace used to have a campaign against Brazilian cattle, and now it's not there. You know, a lot of these organizations actually did talk about it in the 80s and early 90s. Mm-hmm. And then I think that there's a shift. There's a cultural shift, but I think the lawsuit against Oprah Winfrey and Howard Lyman really played a role in that. It was, you know, Oprah Winfrey said that she would never eat another hamburger again after having Howard Lyman on her show talking about mad cow disease, and they were sued by a group of Texas cattlemen under a food disparagement law. And I think that sent a real shockwave through a lot of media and a lot of organizations that if this industry would be willing to go after the biggest celebrity in entertainment, Oprah Winfrey, over talking ill against their product, well, what hope does an organization have? And I think that still resonates through our society today.
It's pretty scary, and Chris Hedges touches on it. He called it inverted totalitarianism, and it can be very debilitating for all of us to feel like we cannot make a difference. And if we try to, we can be put in jail or snuffed out. And you tell some pretty chilling stories of what goes on here in the United States. And you also talked about some things that have gone on in Brazil in terms of people that have been murdered. Nuns.
Yeah. And this is an industry, I mean, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, is an industry of violence. It makes its living off of the death and bodies of living creatures, is involved in the most destructive forms of environmental degradation on the planet. And so to silence activists, you know, Dorothy Stang, the U.S.-born nun who was working in Brazil, fighting against the destruction of Amazon forest there, you know, it's not far outside their reach. And, but then, you know, here at home, United States, you know, animal activists and environmental activists are considered the number one domestic terrorist threat, according to the FBI. And it's because, you know, it's a threat to their industry. And then again, these are violent industries, and so they'll use violent repression if they feel necessary.
And we're all kind of reeling from the recent terrorist acts in Paris. We've had terrorist attacks on our own land, 2001, of course, the 9/11 attacks. We have terrorism by our own people in our schools. We have terrorism by white-collar crimes, by big corporations, and yet the ones who have the most difficult law against them, this Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, to frighten and scare and prevent animal activists from revealing the horrors that are going on, this is fascism. This is scary.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it really shows the power of this industry to dictate legislation and dictate laws in this country.
Yeah. Anyway, so I'm glad you're telling this story, guys.
Oh, thank you. I think it's a story that needs to get out. You know, people don't know about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. They don't know about animal agriculture's impact and major role in climate change. And so that's the focus of the film, and obviously the clear focus of the book is to try and get this information out to as many people as possible so that they can make informed decisions on how they think it's best to live.
Okay, so you've had great results with the film Cowspiracy, and anybody who hasn't seen it, you can go on Netflix and stream it anytime. Now, you've got this book, The Sustainability Secret, and as I said before, for me, it's a great history book. So can we get it in the schools?
Yeah, we would love that. The book is kind of tailored for university students, and that's where the demographic we were really thinking about, because they're individuals who are starting out their adult lives and have the ability to make decisions, hopefully, on their own. Getting into public schools is often going to be a challenge because, one, school boards are very strict on what they allow in, and then, two, children oftentimes don't have the choice to make what they eat. That's dictated by their parents. So this is really focused towards university students, and we'd love to see it adapted into curriculums.
Yeah, I could see it working very well in a college environment because that tends to be a good time in a human's life where we feel we can make a difference and we want to do something. And then somehow many of us, after we get a job, we kind of settle down and get complacent and buried with bills and taking kids to soccer games.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. So, okay, what's been the reaction so far to – tell me some good news. I mean, we've talked about the issues that are covered in the film and in the book are very upsetting. It's reality, but difficult to take. And now I want to hear some good reactions, how people are changing the world as a result of seeing your film and reading your new book.
Well, what it is the timing was so perfect for the film that it was almost inevitable of this transformation that's taking place so fast, call it the next step in evolution or whatever you want to call it. You see companies like Hampton Creek, they do Beyond Egg. They're now the fastest growing food company in the entire planet. The entire world, and that's a plant-based food. We are showing, I'm going to Brussels, Belgium in 2 weeks to show Cowspiracy to the EU Parliament. And so, and then going to the Paris and the whole climate change, and there's a big gathering there. So the information's getting out there, and everybody is just turned on, and it's, you know, everybody's saying it's about time, and it's such a relief that this time has come, and it's come, you know, just in time.
Yeah, I mean, we've also, I mean, in the first month that Cowspiracy was up on Netflix, we had over 20,000 people sign up for our 30-day vegan challenge on our website. So it's inspiring, you know, hundreds of thousands of people around the world to look at their diet differently. And then, you know, 20,000 of them that we know for sure who are actually making that pledge to change their diet. And we hear from people all around the world who are being inspired and figuring out creative ways of getting this information out to more people. You know, Cowspiracy is a tool, and it's a tool to spread information. And so people can use it in that way to just get this conversation going and make sure that animal agriculture is at the forefront of the environmental discussion.
Woo. That's really good news. I'm very happy to hear that.
Well, thank you. We're very excited about the European Parliament's screening. And then we've also had a lot of attention from U.S. senators and legislators from around the United States who are also interested in the film.
And which senators are those?
You probably could guess them.
Somehow I'm not imagining they're part of the Republican Party.
Probably not.
Although there is one, there was who wrote the book, the Republican speechwriter for George Bush. His name was Morgan. I can't remember right now. The one Republican vegan.
Yeah, he wrote the book Dominion.
Dominion. There we go. Yeah. What does that say about our parties?
Yeah. I mean, the Democrats have been pretty silent on the issue as well. I mean, Dennis Kucinich was one of the, I think, shining lights in U.S. politics for a long time.
That's right. And now we have Cory Booker.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, hopefully they'll watch your film and read your book and start getting real about what we really need going in our government, because we need government help. I like to say that we should all vote with our dollar, and we can all make a difference with the products that we choose to buy. That means, for me, not buying any animal products, no meat, fish, dairy, eggs, and personal care products with animal products in it, and clothing, leather and wool and silk. They're all related, and they all involve exploitation, and they all destroy the environment. But the government can help tremendously, and they can help for those people that are in businesses that involve non-human animals. They can provide support for them to transition to something that is more environmentally friendly and kinder.
Absolutely. You know, we're already subsidizing animal agriculture to the tune of over $100 billion. We can easily subsidize farmers to, instead of destroy the environment, to actually be stewards of the environment. Allow ranchers who are subsidized by the federal government, instead of running cattle, to actually allow that land to come back, to allow land to be reforested, to protect native wildlife. And these are all things that could be done with our tax dollars that aren't being done because of private industry. But that could change. And I think that's just going to take an awakening of the general public to get behind this message and to push that through government.
There are a lot of numbers in your book, a lot of data, a lot of percentages, numbers that just blow your mind because you can't comprehend them. They're just so big. But one thing I want to talk about, you hit all the issues about food and how it impacts environment and treatment of animals and health. Everything's covered. It's great. I want to just talk briefly about fish, because as the mainstream moves along in terms of their cumulative knowledge, I think a lot of people are understanding now that red meat isn't healthy. They should probably eat less meat. People have been led to believe they should eat more chicken and now more fish. And it's going to take a while to kind of get that information into them that fish isn't any better, and it's so devastating to the environment. Can you touch on some of those realities?
Well, one thing on you saying, talking about health alone, that's actually, I feel kind of the shift away towards fish is happening really fast, especially over the next 2 years, because all the studies coming out of the mercury, the radiation, dioxins that are falling into the ocean, and the accumulation that's happening into the ocean and into these fish, it's basically like when you're eating fish, it's like Russian roulette. And the buildup, the more you eat, the more it builds up in your body. So from a health standpoint, it's terrible, let alone the omegas that why people eat it, the omegas and the DHA, that is now dropped because you have farmed fish and they're not eating as much algae as they are. So, and the saturated fat that is cholesterol, it's just very unhealthy. But then for environmental point of it, yeah, the fish, the oceans, as some estimates are, is that it's going to be essentially collapsed by the year 2050. We might see fishless oceans essentially by the year 250, which is, you know, only a few decades away. And that is scary because the ocean is a living, breathing thing. It's just like the rainforest. As Paul Watson says, when the oceans die, we die. And it's true. People are just starting to learn how important the ocean is to the entire ecosystem. And most people who really study environmentalism know that that's the part we need to focus on. It's the oceans. That's the scary, scary part. And there's no such thing as a sustainable fishing. Sustainable fishing is called you stop fishing.
Very important. Now, there are people that are focusing on climate change and wanting to quickly get to sustainable energy sources and reduce and eliminate our dependency on fossil fuels. You talk quite a bit about climate change. And one thing about the oceans, it is connected to climate change, but it affects the environment on so many more levels. And that's why when I talk to people about climate change, the importance of going vegan is so essential, because if we ever do get to change, get to more sustainable energy sources, the devastation just from fishing and eating animals is going to kill us before the climate gets out of control.
That's it. I mean, they're looking at emissions coming from animal agriculture, but from agriculture in general, are expected to increase 80% by the year 2050. When you compare that to the emissions increasing from the energy sector, only projected to increase about 20%. So our emissions from animal agriculture are just going to push us way over the edge. But as you said, you know, it's not just climate change. It's the fact that we are destroying forests at an astounding rate, which is going to just only make the issues of climate change even worse. It's the fact that, you know, close to a third of the African sub-Saharan continent won't have enough water to meet their food needs on a daily basis. It's the fact that we're in the largest mass extinction the planet has ever seen. You know, more species are dying now than 65 million years ago when all the dinosaurs died off. And we're in dire times, and the primary driver of that is animal agriculture. But there's this very big shimmer of positivity. There's a researcher from University of Illinois and Dr. Slesh Rao from Climate Healers who have been doing some preliminary research on the ability of grasslands to sequester carbon. And what they've found is that if you removed all of the cattle on grasslands that was formerly forest and allow the forest to come back, we'd be able to sequester more carbon from the atmosphere than we put into it in the last 250 years. So basically, we'd be able to reverse all of climate change simply by removing cattle off of grasslands and allowing it to revert to forests. And that's huge. And that buys us the time to figure out how to live more sustainably with renewable energies and get off of fossil fuels.
That is huge, and it's very inspiring, and it kind of flies in the face of those who believe that eating free-range animals because it's more, quote, humane, is far more problematic.
Absolutely. Dr. Richard Oppenlander, who wrote Comfortably Unaware, Food Choice and Sustainability, writes about that extensively, that you know, buying local and organic isn't going to be enough. And the reality is right now there's a roundup of wild horses. About 1,400 wild horses are being rounded up off of federal land in Oregon to make room for Whole Foods grass-fed beef suppliers.
Oh.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, so this is the whole movement towards grass-fed and sustainable, or quote-unquote sustainable, is anything but that. It's actually more destructive. It takes more energy, more resources to raise animals on pasture than in factory farms.
Yeah, we need to repeat that. So all of you folks out there who are trying to eat more plant foods and think that eating fish is okay and eating humanely raised beef and eggs is a good thing, and dairy, it's not. It's bad for the environment, and it's certainly not good for your health. And it's, you know, even though the animals may be treated a little bit better, and even in your book you talk about how a lot of the farms that are organic aren't really any different than the ones that aren't in terms of kind treatment of the animals. The only way to really make a difference is to just eat plants today.
So easy.
It's easy and it's delicious.
Yeah.
Well, Kip and Keegan, thank you. You've done tremendous work. It's a privilege to be able to speak with you today and to read your book and see the film. And best of luck with the EU showing your film and with the climate change talks in Paris. Make change.
Thank you so much. Yeah, exciting times.
Thanks so much for having us.
Okay, take care. That was Kip Anderson and Keegan Kuhn. They have a new book out called The Sustainability Secret. And if you've seen the film Cowspiracy or not, the book is an excellent resource with all the reasons, all the answers why we want you to eat plants. Okay, I just have a few seconds left. I'm Karen Hartglass, and please send me any messages and comments to info@realmeals.org. Thanksgiving is coming up, and that's a big favorite vegan holiday. And, of course, I hope yours is turkey-free, and we're going to make that easy for you. If you visit responsibleeatingandliving.com, we have wonderful Thanksgiving recipes. We have our Thanksgiving feast food show. It's fun to watch, and the recipes are great. And we have our real Thanksgiving favorite recipes, so please check them out. It includes deep dish apple pie and pumpkin pie, all the things that you need for a great Thanksgiving feast. Again, I'm Karen Hartglass. This has been It's All About Food. Have a delicious week and keep tuning in, love.